Hello, welcome to the program. As religion withers in the liberal West, what takes its place? What replaces it as a marker of identity or community? I'm Andrew West, and this is the Religion and Ethics Report. Canadian psychologist and author Jordan Peterson was in Australia to discuss his new book, 12 Rules for Life, An Antidote to Chaos. In this extended conversation, we range over many deep questions.
Stories sit at the bottom of our cognitive architecture. We look at the world through stories because we're creatures in motion. You know, we're somewhere and we're going somewhere, and we have a set of tasks to undertake along the way. And things go wrong sometimes, and that's the story. I was somewhere, I was going somewhere else, and here's the interesting things that happened along the way. Here's the problems that emerged and how I solved them. Here's the travails I had to undertake, and here's what the value of that was, for better or for worse. And that's how we interpret the world. And there are foundational stories. And for better or for worse, the foundational story of Western culture is the Bible. And I actually am quite an admirer of Western culture. I think it's produced the freest, richest, best societies that certainly that exist on the planet now, and that I would say have ever existed. And so that makes me respectful of the foundational stories. And I also know that those stories have been generated over thousands and thousands of years by the collective efforts of many, many people.
What do you still like about Christianity and about the stories? And you seem to sense an instrumental value in Christianity, if not a question of metaphysical belief.
Well, it depends to some degree on what you mean by belief. Like, I do believe that people, I think the idea of crucified divinity is an unbelievably powerful idea. I think that people are touched by the divine. We have the capacity for intense religious experience and for meaningful experience. And we do, there's an element of us that's grounded in the divine. And I think we are a hybrid of the infinite and the finite. And I think that we live crucified lives. We're at the center of the tragedy of being, each and every one of us. And the proper response to that is to take your heavy load and to bear it upwards. That's the right way to live. And so that's a hallmark of belief, let's say. One of the ideas that's central to Christianity is the imitation of Christ. One question might be, well, what exactly does that mean? It doesn't mean to travel to the Middle East and to reenact the crucifixion. It means to accept the tragic limitations of your own life nobly and to struggle upwards towards the light regardless of that, and to orient yourself towards the highest good that you can imagine, and to live in truth and to accept responsibility for the state of the world.
And I think you say to develop character in the face of suffering, because suffering will be inevitable. The magnitude will differ, but the suffering itself will be inevitable in some form.
Everyone knows that. You don't have to scratch below the surface when discussing people's lives with them to find the manners in which they're currently or previously touched by tragedy. Everyone has to face the death of people that they love. They face their own illnesses. All of those things, everyone has to face those. And sometimes at a level of catastrophic load. The question is, how is it that you orient yourself to be propelled forward through those things without becoming corrupted and embittered by them, which is a very bad outcome?
I see 12 Rules for Life, An Antidote to Chaos, your book, as, well, less a self-help book and more a sense of grappling with some big moral questions. It seems the biggest moral question, though, in an era when Christianity is on the decline in the global north, rising dramatically in China and the global south, but certainly according to Pew Research, it's on the decline in the north. The big moral question is, what replaces religion?
So
what is or what does replace religion?
How about Marxism? How about fascism?
Neither very successfully. So,
well, I guess it depends on your definition of success. If you want to stack up the corpses, Marxism and fascism are your avenue forward. But if you want to produce a society that's civil and that alleviates suffering and that allows people the possibility of at least tolerable individual lives and maybe more than that, then you don't turn in that direction, that's for sure. You need an image of the divinity and transcendent power of the individual, and you don't find that in fascism or Marxism. All you find is tribalism and collectivism, and then every horror that comes along with that.
So is part of your profession, in a way, psychology replacing religion?
Well, hopefully not replacing, but perhaps helping to explain consciously. I think this is the case particularly for thinkers like Carl Jung, or Mircea Eliade is a good example as well. These people who spent their lives decoding the psychological significance of profound narratives. It's time, I think, in the West that we have to make our religious presuppositions conscious and articulate rather than merely embedded in story and drama. Mm. We have to understand them in order to reunite with them. And we need to reunite with them, because if we lose our foundational stories, then we lose our culture.
Well, we lose more than that, because I noticed that you write that without a profound system of values, we're drawn to nihilism. So where do you see this slide into nihilism happening today? I get it that we saw it in the 20th century with Soviet-style communism, with Nazi Germany, but where are we seeing the slide into nihilism today?
I think it's part and parcel of the entire identity politics movement. As people turn to tribal identity when they can't find an identity that's more satisfying than that. It's a default position to identify with your tribe. I think that we see the consequence of nihilism in the universities of today. I think the universities have no shortage of sins on their conscience, let's say. They teach postmodern neo-Marxist ideology in the place of profound education to young people and warp and bend them and distort the entire social fabric. That's a big problem, and it's a growing problem as far as I'm concerned.
Your critique of the universities is not that they teach about Marxism. It's what? That they teach
a politics.
Yeah. Rather than questioners.
Exactly. Well, no, the conclusion is already put in place. The West is a corrupt patriarchy. It's a view of the world that puts group identity in the paramount position. And I think the evidence that is overwhelmingly dangerous is incontrovertible. And nonetheless, that's what the universities do. And I mean, the real activist disciplines like women's studies, for example, and all the ethnic studies, they make no secret of this. They're out to produce activists, and the activists are aimed at the reconstruction, deconstruction, demolition, and replacement of the corrupt Western patriarchy. It's not hidden. And it's such an elementary view of the world. There's no excuse for it.
So I'm hoping that you think the correct model is one that asks us to question.
Well, I mean, if your life is everything you think it could be, then you don't need to question. But I have yet to meet someone who's in that fortunate position. And if you think that your ignorance might be contributing to your unnecessary suffering, then, of course, you should open up your eyes and your ears, and you might find yourself fortunate enough to learn something of value, then you won't fall into a pit. Anyone with any sense has a continually questioning attitude, not least about what they themselves believe, because there's so much that you don't know compared to what you do know, and maybe some of it will help you. That's what you'd hope for.
It's the Religion and Ethics Report. My guest, Jordan Peterson, author of 12 Rules for Life, An Antidote to Chaos. Jordan, does all of this go back to the story of Adam and Eve and their fall in the Garden of Eden? Because you clearly love that story, because it is a recurring theme in your book.
It's an amazing story. You never get to the bottom of that story, no matter how far you dig. It's an absolutely unbelievable story. Well, it's, in my estimation, it's a story of the coming to self-consciousness of the human race. We woke up, and not so long ago, you know. We woke up and we realized that we died. We realized that we were mortal. The scales fell from our eyes and we saw our own death. And that produced a cataclysmic, what would you call it? A cataclysmic break in the structure of reality. At the same time, we became aware of evil. Once you realize that you're vulnerable, this is what differentiates human beings from animals, one of the things. Once you realize that you're vulnerable, once you know that you can be hurt, then you know how to hurt other people and you can make it into an art form. And it's in that manner that evil enters the world, is with the conscious understanding of how to manipulate the vulnerabilities of other people and yourselves, and then to take advantage of that. That's just where it starts, but that's a good beginning. That's all detailed out in the story of Adam and Eve.
Yeah, well, the other biblical motif that you draw on, I think perhaps slightly too much sometimes, but it is very powerful, and that's the story of Cain and Abel. Why do you think this story echoes down the millennia?
Well, I think partly because it's such a horrifying story. It's very short, right? It's less than a paragraph long.
Yeah.
But Cain and Abel both make sacrifices to God. Well, I explain that. I mean, everyone makes sacrifices. You make a sacrifice when you delay gratification and decide to put something off now so that you can benefit in the future. It's the discovery of time. The discovery of sacrifice and the discovery of the future are the same thing. And so Cain and Abel make sacrifices to God in order to order their lives and to thrive. And it works for Abel, but it doesn't work for Cain. The story isn't exactly clear why, but it seems plausible. It seems to be intimated in the story that Cain's sacrifices are not everything they could be. In any case, his sacrifices are rejected by God. Abel thrives. Everyone loves him. Everything goes well for him. But Cain plays second fiddle constantly, and it makes him terribly bitter. And he takes his case up before God, and he says something like, "How dare you construct a reality where I work myself to the bone for nothing while my favored brother has nothing but benefits as a consequence? How dare you make a world like that?" And God essentially says, "Look to your own devices before you criticize the structure of the world. I place the sin at your feet, not at mine." And that enrages Cain to the degree that he kills Abel. And that's the first story about human beings in our foundational narrative, because Adam and Eve were made by God. They're not real human beings in some sense. Cain and Abel are the hostile brothers, right? They're precursor to Christ and Satan.
So where do we see the Cain and Abel parable being lived out again and again today?
Oh, you see it with the school shooters in the United States. They're all possessed by the spirit of Cain. They're all resentful and bitter because their sacrifices have gone unrewarded. They all desire to destroy the ideal and to take revenge against God. That's what's being played out.
Do we see it in religious extremists of all faiths?
Well, that's a more complicated situation. I mean, I think that...
We surely see it in Islamic State.
I think it's more complicated because people there are also possessed by the spirit of group identification. So you have an interplay there between group identification and the desire to destroy. Whereas with the school shooters, it's more purely the desire for revenge against being. So, you know, it isn't as though the school shooter types are simultaneously stating, here's an ethos that we put forward. Whereas the ISIS people at least purport to be religious fundamentalists, right? They have an ethos that goes along with their murderousness.
The other source that you cite often is the great Russian dissident writer Alexander Solzhenitsyn. He wrote, I remember from high school, A Day in the Life of Ivan Denisovich and then the Gulag Archipelago. And he said something to the effect of that the line that divides good and evil cuts through the heart of every being. This is very scary. It's very compelling. Can I ask you, as an experienced psychologist, does this mean that we're all capable of being Mahatma Gandhi and a concentration camp guard at Auschwitz-Birkenau?
More likely the latter than the former.
Yeah.
It's easier to descend than to ascend. And people are capable of horrors that they can barely imagine. And that's what you learn from studying history. People think history is about what other people did in the past. And I suppose that's one way of looking at it. But the wise person who reads history knows that it's an autobiography. That's a good way of thinking about it. And yeah. So we're capable of things that we can hardly imagine.
Yeah, well, I think you made the point that, look, we're more intelligent than animals, not more sentient, but we're more intelligent. But we're also the only species that inflicts suffering for the sake of suffering.
Yeah, that's the critical distinction right there, is that we can inflict suffering. It can and will inflict suffering merely for the joy of that, more for the vengeful joy of that. Now, when you look at Sandy Hook, for example, where one of the school shooters shot up elementary kids, killed elementary school kids, you think, well, what drives someone to do that? It's like, well, if you're going to punish and hurt, you hurt the innocent, not the guilty, right? Because that's more punishing and more hurtful. It's more evil, you could say, with a good deal of justification. So, and it's necessary for people to constrain that capacity within themselves. And it's far more present within people than they really generally are willing to see or admit.
So, Jordan, is the antidote to that a strong sense of guilt? Because if you say today to people that you know, guilt, a bit of guilt is a good thing. You know, the whole psychology profession, the whole therapy profession, the whole wellness industry will come down on you like a ton of bricks. How dare you make people feel guilty about anything? But is a sense of guilt then the antidote to that temptation to human deprivation?
Well, it's at least a start. I mean, the last thing you ever want to meet is someone who doesn't have the capacity to feel guilt. There's not much difference between that and psychopathy. Now, you know, people do feel unwarranted guilt, I would say, but it's necessary to take. I would think about it more in terms of responsibility than guilt, though. Responsibility, in some sense, I suppose, is the guilt that you take on voluntarily. You're responsible for straightening out your life. It isn't clear that you're responsible for your capability, for the capability that you have for good or for evil. That's part of your nature in some sense, but it's part of what's given to you. But you do have the responsibility to minimize the one and maximize the other. Mm. And the sense of guilt when you make a moral error is an unbelievably helpful guide. It can go out of control, just like anxiety can, and just like frustration and disappointment. Any emotion can dominate to the point where it becomes pathological, but beware the man who is incapable of feeling guilt. That's not someone that you want to.
So we should carry around with us a bit of latent guilt as a check on what we might do.
That would be good. Well, I suppose that's part of the wisdom of the idea of original sin, you know, is that we're fallen creatures. We're striving upward, but damaged in our current condition. And I also think everyone understands that. You rarely meet a person who's entirely satisfied with their own mode of being. They feel that they're insufficient in many, many ways. I mean, the only people you ever see who aren't like that are narcissistic, and then that's shallow generally. You don't have to scratch very far until you find the insecurity underneath narcissism. Mm.
On the Religion and Ethics Report with Andrew West, I'm speaking with Jordan Peterson, author of 12 Rules for Life. Jordan's a psychologist and a professor at the University of Toronto and a YouTube sensation. I guess I don't have to tell you that. Jordan, you deal a lot and you invoke biblical stories a lot, but the other person that you invoke, and I just can't quite get to the bottom of your relationship with him, but the other person you invoke is the philosopher Friedrich Nietzsche. He was the one who declared God is dead. Do you like Nietzsche?
I think it's more a matter of standing in awe in relationship to his incredible verbal fluency and perceptual brilliance. Mm. No, he said God was dead, but he also said we'll never find enough water to wash away the blood. Mm. It's not a triumphalist statement, even though people often read it that way. It's more an indication that the foundation has been kicked out from underneath our culture and that the entire building is in danger of falling. That was his prognosis. Yes,
but isn't Nietzsche cited approvingly over the decades by those who've said, look, Christianity, it's soft, it's, you know, too much of this turn the other cheek, it's not masculine enough. Is there not a connection? Is there not, if not a direct line, then a squiggly line between Nietzsche and the gulag and Nietzsche and the gas chamber?
No, I don't think so. I mean, Nietzsche is a very, very complicated thinker. I mean, he was one of humanity's great geniuses, and people don't take the time to actually read what he wrote. I've read most of what he wrote, at least what was published up till about the 1990s. He's a very multi-dimensional thinker and not easy to sum up or systematize. You actually have to read what he says. He took dogmatic Christianity to task because he thought that the load that people carried had been lightened too much by the church, which is also something that Dostoevsky said almost in exactly the same manner. Nietzsche knew that Christ's call to Christians was the imitation of Christ, not the mere adherence to the stated belief that Christ's sacrifice had redeemed mankind for all times. And so Nietzsche, when he was criticizing Christianity, I mean, sometimes your best friend is your harshest critic. And I think it's reasonable to read Nietzsche in that light. Look, something's gone wrong with Christianity, with the institutions of Christianity in the North. In the West,
and
right?
It's
failing.
Yeah, well, it's failing in Australia in dramatic ways because, you know, we had a royal commission into widespread sexual abuse. Although something's failing with the institutional church.
Right, that's the thing. That's exactly it. The institutional church doesn't call to people anymore, and that's not necessary. You know, I did biblical lectures last year in Toronto, I did 15 of them, I think, and I didn't get past Genesis, and I thought I would get farther than that, but I didn't. But the You've got a while to go. yes, that's for sure.
Well, shall I check back in 50 years?
Well, that's exactly right. Well, I'm certainly hoping to get to Exodus and the rest of the books of Moses this year. But the first of those videos has 1.6 million views. It's not like there isn't an appetite for this sort of information, but it has to have some teeth in it again. Mm. You know, one of the things I've talked to people about is there's an injunction in the New Testament, which is the meek shall inherit the earth. And it sounds like an invitation to, well, to the sort of turn the other cheek philosophy that you just described, which is, by the way, a very complicated idea. But that's not a good translation of that statement. Meek was translated poorly. And what that statement really means is something like, those who have swords and know how to use them but keep them sheathed will inherit the world. And that's a lot different, and that's also a much more saleable message, let's say, a much more attractive, psychologically compelling message to young men in particular. Mm. Because you can call out to young men and say, look, it's up to you to develop yourself into the most horrible monster you can possibly imagine, and then discipline yourself intensely so you're a good person. That's a call to adventure.
Yeah, but the other call is that which you do to the least of my brothers, you do to me. The first shall be last and the last shall be first.
Yeah.
So I don't think we can overlook the softness, as it were,
I don't think of the New Testament and of Christ. I don't think that those are soft statements at all. Mm. I mean, the last shall be first is a call to humility. Mm. At least in part, it's to say, look, there's so much that you have to learn that you have to continually keep yourself in a state of humility and to bow down before your own ignorance, and to ensure that you listen and attend, because your house is not in order and the things that you think are important, you're missing what's important. You're constantly missing what's important. It's funny because you wouldn't think of humility as a form of strength, but humility is the form of strength that allows you to learn the new thing and abandon what you no longer need and to let go of what you no longer need.
Jordan Peterson, let's wind up by discussing another of the really big moral questions that you throw up. And here it is, direct quote, above all, don't lie. Don't lie about anything ever. Ever?
That would be best. Look, a central tenet of the Judeo-Christian ethic, let's say, is the sacredness of the logos. That's communicative speech. That's the speech that brings order out of chaos. It's the speech that makes habitable order in the world. You have to be very careful about what you say.
Jordan, this throws up a very interesting dilemma for me, though, as a journalist of 25 years, because when I interview someone, I want to get truthful answers to my questions, but don't questions have to have a good motive if they are to deserve the truth?
I think that if you're being questioned by someone who has questionable motives, then it's up to you to discern the motives of the questioner and to try to react to the degree that you can in keeping with that. Mm. It's very difficult. I mean, believe me, I understand what you're saying.
Yeah, I mean, look, if I ask a wealthy businessman or woman who is personally known or whose company is known to evade taxes that would otherwise build, you know, our shared society, if I say, how much money have you gotten in the bank and how much taxes haven't you paid? I would say that is in the public interest. But do I have a right to ask you about the sex life that you have with your wife? I mean,
Just because I'm obligated to tell the truth doesn't mean that I don't have a right to privacy. Mm. I mean, if you asked me that, I could say, well, that, as far as I'm concerned, is in the private domain and not relevant to this conversation. And that's the truth. Truth and full disclosure at every moment are not the same thing. Mm. You can still have boundaries.
Yeah.
I mean, because sometimes the truth is you have no business asking me that question. Often that's the truth in that situation.
So there is wiggle room here. I mean, you know, the obvious example, because you deal with the heaviest questions of all in this book, is, you know, it's Berlin 1940 or Amsterdam 1942 and the Nazis knock on your door. You don't have a moral obligation to tell them about the Jews in your cellar, do you?
I think that by the time that you're in that situation, you've made so many mistakes that you're not in a position where you can make the right decision anymore. You can find yourself in a situation where the best thing that offers itself to you is a lie. But what that means is that many things were undone on the pathway that led you there.
Explain that in concrete terms, because I think of the person who's standing in front of the Gestapo guard lying about the people they're protecting as a moral person who's made moral choices. But where are the mistakes made along the way in that circumstance? That is a fascinating point that you make.
Well, who knows how many million decisions had to remain unmade for the Nazis to attain power in Germany. I mean, I've watched this over the last year and a half as our society polarizes increasingly. It's staggering the degree to which people are sufficiently intimidated so they won't stand up and say what they think. And, you know, if you don't stand up and say what you think, you allow your society to corrupt itself around you. And you make yourself weak as that corruption process occurs. And then you'll find yourself in a situation where there is no good action. There is no decent action. All you have in front of you is various pathways to hell. So, you know, the great commentators on the horrors of the 20th century, certainly Solzhenitsyn among them, but also people like Viktor Frankl, made a very strong case that it was the individual proclivity to abandon responsibility and the truth that paved the way for the domination of totalitarians and then the eventual horrors that accompanied their ascent. Mm. You can get a long way in the early stages of a movement by just refusing to budge. It's like, I'm not doing that. You see something happening that you think is part of the pathway on the road to perdition. You say, I'm not participating in that game. And that has to happen early. Mm. So many, many things went wrong in Europe in the middle of the last century. And of course, the situation in Holland was a consequence of many, many, many bad decisions. And
yeah,
action should have been taken far earlier.
Look, just finally, Jordan, what's the basis of a good conversation? And I have to say this because echoing in my mind, of course, is the infamous interview that you did on Channel 4 in the UK. What's the basis of a good conversation? Because that's a big part of this book.
I outline that in Rule 9, yeah. Assume that the person you're listening to might know something you don't. Well, I would say it's humility. The humility is, unless your life is everything you think it should be, then you have something to learn. And it's possible that the person that you're talking to, particularly if they don't agree with you, but are being honest in their reactions, they might have something to tell you that you don't know. They might be able to shed a light on one of your blind spots. And then you don't have that blind spot anymore. And so you should go into a conversation desperate for the possibility that this person may fill in a gap that is crippling you in some manner. And they should go into the conversation with the same attitude. Mm. And then you generate the logos between you, and hopefully that helps redeem both of you. That's what we've got. That's the alternative to tyranny and slavery, that negotiated dialogue.
Well, I hope we've had a good conversation today. Jordan Peterson is the author of 12 Rules for Life, An Antidote to Chaos. He's a psychologist. He's a professor at the University of Toronto. As I say, a YouTube sensation, but I guess I don't have to tell you that because that precedes you, that reputation. Jordan, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks very much for the opportunity.
Next week on the summer edition of the Religion and Ethics Report, the political philosopher Patrick Deneen. He's at Notre Dame University in the US, and his 2018 book, Why Liberalism Failed, was a surprise bestseller, partly because I think former US President Barack Obama tweeted that it was at the top of his summer reading list. And Patrick Deneen asks, essentially, has liberalism just become licentiousness? Has liberalism become merely about, you might say, the freedom to shop and the freedom to shag? That's something to look forward to, a very provocative piece. Thanks to Mudita Dias and to Wayne Newen. I'm Andrew West. I'm back next week.